Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The sky is blue. Fact, right? Well, not really, because it in fact changes color depending on time of day and where you are. Okay, here's another one. It is wrong to murder another human being. That's true, right? Except that in war, and frequently in the courts, the taking of another life is seen as justified and even forgiven. So how about this one? President Joe Biden freely and fairly won the 2020 presidential election. There was no widespread voter fraud. Well, that one is a quantifiably, measurably, and replicable fact. Quantifiable, measurable, and replicable. And yet, it is not the truth to everyone. More than half of Republicans continue to believe the election was stolen. So these are just a couple of examples of a society in the midst of what Jonathan Rauch calls an epistemic crisis. He's author of the new book, The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth, and he joins us now. Jonathan, welcome to On Point.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, I'd love to start with some definitions. Epistemic crisis. What do you mean?
That's when a society, small tribe, major nation, whatever, loses the ability to agree on what facts are and how we get to facts for public purposes. And symptoms of that include polarization, forking realities, extreme incivility and hostility, and a strange disorientation.
A strange disorientation. Okay, tell me a little bit more about that last one.
Well, a good example is the one that you just began with. What happened in the election in 2020? Two completely different stories, no clear way to bring them together. One side just will not believe what the other side believes. This becomes disorienting, and a lot of people in the middle don't really know what to believe anymore. They're in a kind of state of confusion, disorientation. Well, which side is right? And who hacked the Democratic server in 2016? Was it the Ukrainians or the Russians? We'll never know. We don't know who to believe. We don't know who to trust.
So this is the key thing about the idea of an epistemic crisis, because it's not just there are no shared facts anymore or universally agreed upon facts, is that people don't even know how to know or how we come about forming those facts or judging those truths. So it's a hijacking of even the processes of coming up with reliable knowledge.
That is exactly right. People never agree on facts. That's the fundamental truth about all human societies. And it's how societies have to deal with the problem of bringing together people who disagree. And they'll continue to disagree, but what we hope they can agree on is a process that leads society toward being able to draw conclusions, at least for public purposes. Like, you know, some people believe Elvis Presley is still alive. Do we send him a Social Security check? No. A lot of people may still believe that, but for public purposes, we figured out a way to come to a conclusion. When that breaks down, it's not that we all have to agree, but when we can't agree even on a process, that's the epistemic crisis, and that's what's happening now.
So in your book, you hold to account in terms of the creation of this epistemic crisis, both the right and the left. And I'm going to want to dive into specific examples of that later in the show. But in a sense, you open the book with this conundrum, though, that this question of how we know what we know is as old as humanity itself. I mean, you start with the ancient Greeks. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's the starting question of all philosophy, Meghna. How do we know truth? And how do we know when we know truth? Because we could at any moment be wrong. Of course, you know, for all of us, there are times we were certain we were right, only discover that we were wrong. This is a problem that plagues humanity. The ancients knew it. Modern psychology has greatly elaborated on it. So we know a lot now. We know that human brains we're very good at distinguishing, you know, what's true in immediate circumstances that involve life and death or major stakes, and where we get immediate feedback, like, is that a tiger in the bush or is that a breeze? Or where is the next tribe camp? But on bigger abstract questions like what God do we worship or where does disease come from, we're bad at that. Mm. And we're wired to believe things that increase our status in our group and that confirm our identities and our pre-existing beliefs, our biases. Well, that's a recipe for entire societies to go down rabbit holes of confirming what they think to each other, believing what your friends believe, confirming your biases. That's, you know, in a small scale, that's the Reverend James Jones and his cult down there in Guyana. On a very large scale, it's the Soviet Union, or it often ends up the sects will break up into smaller sects, go to war with each other. And on a large scale, that's the wars of religion, which lasted 100 years, killed maybe 30% of the population of Germany. That's how people throughout time, most of our 200,000 years as a species, that's how we dealt with disagreements about truth. We went to war, we split into sects, and it did not end well.
And so what's different then now? It sounds as if we're just doing the same thing, but a lot faster.
Well, this is why it's so important to have a constitution of knowledge. And even more important is to know that we have a constitution of knowledge, because it worked so well for so long that we kind of forgot that we had this thing. You know, we thought, well, free speech, marketplace of ideas, truth will just automatically arise from that. So that's not the case. Starting, you know, 300, 350 years ago, pick your date, some people, we can name them. They're not obscure. John Locke is maybe the most famous of them. Look around at thousands of years of human suffering, combat, totalitarianism, dictatorships, all getting truth wrong, all doing a terrible job. And they say, there must be a better way to do this. So instead of having rulers decide what's true, you know, a priest or a potentate or a prince or a politburo or something else beginning with P, they say, let's have rules instead of rulers figure this out. Let's set up a system. It's what today we call a social network, in which people check each other's beliefs, and no one gets to decree what's true for everyone else. No one gets to stop the conversation. And only what comes out of that whole process of people checking each other's beliefs, looking for each other's errors, only the surviving beliefs become knowledge. Those are the ones that go in the textbooks. Those are the ones we teach in the school. And this turns out to be a species-transforming technology, because this turns out to be a way to engage literally hundreds of millions of minds around the world today, and thousands of institutions and huge amounts of resources that can pivot and focus on a problem like coronavirus, put those minds to work, organize and organize conversation about them, figure out what truth is. This has transformed our species from small tribes that basically do not increase their knowledge over about 200,000 years very much to the shot that's protecting me from coronavirus right now. That's what the Constitution of Knowledge has done.
But this phrase, the Constitution of Knowledge, though, specifically, what do you mean? Because in the book you write about very clearly about the fact that there are important institutions that make up this Constitution of Knowledge.
Well, this is one of two or three big messages in the book that I hope to try to make a contribution on. We have this idea, if you ask Americans, where does knowledge come from? They'll say, well, you know, the marketplace of ideas, and the best idea wins. And that's fine, that's good. But it leaves out all the important stuff in the middle, because it turns out if all you do is open up an unstructured conversation, peer-to-peer, just people talking to each other, they go right back into their rabbit holes. They talk to people who agree with them. They get online. They look up stuff that they like. They get involved in conspiracy theories. And you're back where you started. So it turns out you need a bunch of structure, like the U.S. Constitution, which has checks and balances, institutions like courts, Congress, administrative agencies, the parties, you name it. All of that stuff, which structures things so that the only way to make law and policy is to compromise, it's all mirrored in the epistemic world, the world of knowledge. And it was set up, in fact, at the same time by some of the same people who said, well, look, if you want to make knowledge, you're going to have to present that knowledge in a structured way to institutions like academic journals, newsrooms, courts of law, government agencies, and you're going to have to make a case for it. And then those institutions are going to follow a bunch of rules, usually using a bunch of experts to inspect the ideas, pass them on to other institutions. It works like the U.S. Constitution because it's got balance of powers, checks and balances. No one individual can make knowledge. You have to submit it to others. Those others will disagree and refer it to yet others. It's also like the U.S. Constitution in that it's based on rules and not individuals. So anybody can vote. Our votes weigh the same. Anyone can conduct an experiment. It has to work no matter where in the world it's conducted or by whom. So these things are actually very similar. They're both open-ended systems that take decision-making out of the hands of particular people and say, you know what? We're giving it to this social network, and we're going to trust that network to come out with right answers. And it won't be perfect, but it'll be a heck of a lot better than anything else that we've ever tried before.
So this constitution of knowledge, as you describe it, you argue that it's given us in the past this foundation of how we know what we know and how we can rely on commonly believed, commonly held truths. But in the minute we have to go before this first break here, Jonathan, I would like to hear how you define truth, because that's always something that I think has been fungible with humanity. But you're saying that there's some particular definition of truth that is worthy of defense. It's the subtitle of your book. We've just got about 30 seconds before the first break here.
Truth is, the way I'm using it, is objective knowledge. It's propositions that have been validated through the constitution of knowledge and stood the test of time.
Okay, so I would think that a lot of listeners hearing this right now, maybe their ears perked up when you used the word objective knowledge. So we're gonna pick up right there when we come back. We're talking this hour with Jonathan Rauch. He's author of the new book, The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth. And we've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And if you happen to be on Twitter or Facebook right now, head to On Point Radio and let us know what you think about how to defend, as Jonathan Rauch puts it, objective truth. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Jonathan Rauch. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, contributing writer at The Atlantic, and he's author of the new book, The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth. We've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Now, Jonathan, in your book, you sort of create this dichotomy of forces that are operating to destroy, to undermine this constitution of knowledge, as you describe it. One is some particular forces of chaos. The other is forces of conformity, as you put it. Interestingly, they seem to be actually diametrically opposed, chaos and conformity, but they're producing the same effect, as you're saying. It's like creating a culture and a society that's challenging our ability to even reliably arrive at shared knowledge. So let's take that first one. The forces of chaos, which are most, I think, powerfully seen in the confluence of politics and modern technology or social media. What's your take about how chaos and trolling and misinformation are undermining our ability to know what we know?
Three words, Meghna. You're being manipulated. That's the second big message of this book. The first is, it's not just a marketplace of ideas, it's a constitution of knowledge. We need to understand it and defend it. It's a lot of norms, a lot of institutions that a lot of people suffered and died to create. Second message, you're being manipulated. There are forces out there. There always have been since day one, since Galileo was in prison, that have said it's inconvenient to have to follow all these rules to decide what's true. I know what's true. I should be able to impose that. I should be able to censor or silence the people who disagree with me, or I'm a dictator or demagogue. Truth, as other people see it, gets in my way. I want to say I won the election. It's inconvenient that other people say I lost it. There have always been enemies. The first one that we're talking about today is a form of information warfare, or actually I call it epistemic warfare, war on our system for creating truth. So what's that? That is organizing, efforts to organize and manipulate the social and media environment for political advantage, specifically to dominate, divide, disorient, and ultimately demoralize a target population. These are old techniques. They've been around at least 100 years since modern media was born. Lenin used them. Hitler, Goebbels used them. Vladimir Putin is a master of them. But the greatest living master of them in the world right now is Donald J. Trump, the greatest propagandist, or at least the greatest innovator in propaganda since the 1930s. So specifically, what are we talking about? It turns out censorship, especially in the age of digital media, is clumsy and ineffective. But you can drown out this whole process that we use to sort truth from fiction by doing what Stephen Bannon, a Trump advisor, called flooding the zone with it's a tactic that's been called the fire hose of falsehood. It's a specialty of the Russians who refined it. And that's when you flood every available media channel and many non-media channels like the courts with so many lies, half-truths, conspiracy theories, and exaggerations that fact-checkers and the media can't begin to keep up. Every time they knock down one, there are 10 more. The public gets confused and disoriented because these stories that are flooding at them, they're not even consistent with each other. They no longer know what to believe or who to believe. They become cynical, divided, polarized. That's what Putin was doing in 2016. Looking for vulnerabilities and then using disinformation to further divide America. And that is what Trump and his forces are doing right now about the 2020 election. Mm. This is the most massive and successful disinformation campaign that's ever been run in the U.S., and it's being run by Americans against other Americans.
Is part of the success of this disinformation campaign, as you describe it, the fact that the media, both broadcast print media, but also, of course, social media, are primed, are in fact incentivized to be propagators of that very disinformation. In the past. Perhaps I'm looking at this too nostalgically in terms of our information society in the past, but that there were more points where people could encounter viewpoints other than their own. Whereas now, because of the way corporate media is structured and definitely because of how social media works by design, those points of overlap, those touch points of different points of view, different analyses have just been reduced to virtually zero.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. I should say that this goes in waves, Magna. This isn't the first big disruption of technology into the media world that we've had. The invention of the penny press and offset printing in the United States in the 19th century created yellow journalism and ridiculous extreme partisan journalism and fake news ran rampant. And it took several decades of really hard work by a lot of people to figure out how to get that under control, setting up ethics codes for journalists, American Society for Newspaper Editors, creating prizes like the Pulitzer, creating journalism schools, all of that stuff that taught us how to regulate this media. So along comes social media after a period of relative stability when people like you and me, if we wanted to put a story into print, we'd have to go talk to an editor. And they would ask some hard questions. And then if we got it wrong, we'd have to run a correction or others in the media would call us out. That worked for a while. Along comes social media. At first, we think, well, this is great. We'll all be able to talk to everyone. We'll have free speech. We'll get a marketplace of ideas. Truth will surface. Didn't work out that way because we forgot about all that stuff in the middle, all of the structures that you need to get people to talk to each other in a way that's organized and productive and says, here's my idea, so that someone else can test the idea, so that people focus on the ideas instead of attacking the person. That went away. And it turned out that social media is basically the profit model mm-hmm. became, well, let's just get attention at any cost. It doesn't matter whether what you say is true or false. What matters is that it engages people and they click on it. And of course, as psychologists could have told us, what engages us is stuff that's very high on emotion and especially on outrage. If someone accuses us of something or calumnizes our group or mocks our sacred ideas, we rush to defend those things. It's how we're wired. We often can't help it. So that means the stuff that spreads online is fake and outrageous. So it turned out that the online world was actually geared in a way that disadvantaged truth. So that was out there. Trolls figured that out in a hurry. They got their first anti-vaxxers and Gamergate. And then in 2015 and 16, along comes a really master propagandist who's very comfortable on social media and who adds to it his ability to use conservative media and eventually the White House. And he takes it to an entire new level, something we've never remotely seen before, because now we've got social media and the White House and the Republican Party or large swaths of it and conservative media or large swaths of it all broadcasting, for example, stuff about, you know, they're changing weather forecasts. They're telling us that it didn't rain on Inauguration Day when it did. And all of that's a warm up for the election. So it's a perfect storm.
Mm-hmm. Well, and regarding the tech part of it, what I think more and more people are finding increasingly appalling is that, as you said, this actually isn't by accident. It's by design, right? There are very specific decisions made by, you know, Facebook, for example, that state clearly they are not interested in the advancement of truth or a robust debate of ideas, but rather they are interested in simply delivering to shareholders. And that's why, I mean, as you well know, Jonathan, Shoshana Zuboff calls it an epistemic coup, that in fact there's a deliberate coup in terms of how we know what we know. So that sort of chaos part of it, I think, is pretty well trodden ground. And I appreciate you bringing it into your analysis here about its impact on the overall constitution of knowledge, as you describe it. In fact, we've got some feedback from listeners here. Ray Russell says both sides can't face the truth or facts. The media seems to be the catalyst, as there are no reliable sources in today's world. Consequently, the public aligns themselves with propaganda they listen to or view. So that's one side of your dichotomy here, Jonathan. I'd love to spend a considerable amount of time on the other side, the conformity side. You say that there's a rise in the pressures towards conformist thinking, and you particularly take aim on the left. And there's sort of different aspects of the left we could explore here. But I was wondering if we could spend a few minutes talking about how you see this happening on university campuses. And here's why, because we'll talk about solutions a little bit later, but one of the solutions you talk about is that a diversity of viewpoints is actually quite important to a healthy constitution of knowledge. What evidence do we have, polling evidence or analyses, about the adequacy or lack of diversity of viewpoints on university campuses now?
Well, we know from lots of survey research that about 2/3 of university students say that they're reluctant to state their true opinions on politics and other controversial matters for fear of calling out and facing other kinds of social retribution. And that's pretty robustly confirmed. And by the way, it's not that different from the same number in American society generally, where about 60% of Americans say they're reluctant to state their true political views because of social pressure. And 1/3 of Americans across, again, by the way, amazingly, all ideologies from the right to the left, 1/3 of Americans say that they worry about losing a job or career opportunities if they're frank about politics. This, according to one study, this is about 4 times the level of chilling that we saw at the height of the McCarthy era. So what we're seeing now on campus, but also increasingly off campus, is an epistemic environment that is hostile to diversity of viewpoint, where people are just afraid to speak out if they disagree.
But tell me more about that, because you actually write in quite a bit of detail about college campuses in particular, and because you consider universities one of the key pillars of this constitution of knowledge. So if we are moving towards a university culture across this country that's supposed to be one of the places where this sort of debating and sorting and filtering of a diversity of ideas then leads to common sets of behaviors and beliefs, and yet we're not having that robust churn, if I can put it that way. I mean, tell me a little bit more about what you've written about the evidence that you see for that.
Well, there's certainly the kinds of polls we talked about there. I interviewed many professors and students for my book. And I frequently heard professors say, for example, and by the way, progressive professors on the left and on the right, this is not an ideological phenomenon, strictly speaking. They said, I'm afraid of my students. I'm afraid of getting investigated if I say the wrong thing. I'm just generally afraid of the climate around here. Students say the same thing. Those students, it turns out, are now the main enforcers of social conformity on campus. Not a majority of students, but a very outspoken minority that's very capable of weaponizing things like investigation so that, you know, a professor might get reported if they use the N-word in a law class where the case is about that word. So that creates a chilled environment. The most poignant comment, I think, in my whole book, I was talking to a rising senior at one of the famous liberal arts colleges. I won't name it, but you've heard of it. And she's saying that she regrets the fact that she has not been exposed to conservative viewpoints in college, even though she's a liberal. And then she said that she gives herself some solace because she says, well, at least I've been exposed to a variety of progressive viewpoints. Hmm. And that just made me cringe, because the core of the Constitution of Knowledge, the very center of why it works, is like the U.S. Constitution, you have to have diversity. We don't see our own biases. We just cannot. And if all we're talking to is people who share our biases, we will make error. We will go wrong. We will go down into epistemic bubbles and rabbit holes. And when you start seeing departments and even disciplines in academia where conservatives are as scarce as hen's teeth, you get a couple problems. One is the chilling effect we talk about, where everybody thinks you're just crazy if you have a certain non-orthodox point of view. But the second is that the science becomes bad. You stop asking the questions that ought to be asked and the challenges that would be posed by other points of view. So we know now, another important source of statistical information, we know now that in some of the humanities and social sciences, conservatives are vanishingly rare. Like, you know, in some fields, 1 in 14, in some fields as low as, you know, 1 in 48. It's not true in every field. It's not true in economics, you know, so forth. And that's becoming an increasing problem. It's a recognized problem in academia, and also getting recognition increasingly is the existence of discrimination, viewpoint discrimination in hiring and in promotion in academia. The good news is academics, including progressive ones, are starting to understand that this is a problem. They want to do good science. They don't want to be in an environment where they're isolated, where there's only one point of view. So there's movement inside the world of science to change that. And that's what we all need to encourage. This shouldn't be an attack on universities. This should be helping universities become their better selves again.
You talk about science, though, but just to be clear, I mean, you're talking about science as in physics, biology, et cetera, or a more broader definition in the world of science?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for asking. Yeah. So I have this term called liberal science that I used in my first book. Now I just call it the reality-based community. Mm. And that's all the truth-seeking professions. And that's not just the hard science. That includes history, literary criticism, wherever people are saying, here's a proposition, I think it's true, subjecting it to organized debates by others, things like peer review or in journalism newsrooms or in courts, you put it in a brief and you put it before a judge, or in the CIA, you red team it and blue team it to find out what the flaws are in this view. I mean, the whole world of the Constitution of Knowledge seeking truth. And that includes, as you say, the main pillar of that, the central pillar, is academia and the research community, including the hard sciences, but also including, you know, humanities, history.
Well, we are talking this hour with Jonathan Rauch. He's author of the new book, The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth. And in his book, he brings to light some rather disturbing facts, such as a recent study in the National Association of Scholars found that of top-ranked liberal arts colleges, according to this study, 39% of them had zero Republican professors, and that almost 80% of academic departments had either zero Republicans or so few as to make no difference. Now, if you're listening right now, I want to know if that troubles you or not. So let us know. We're at On Point Radio on Twitter and Facebook. We'll be right back with a lot more. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Ed Yong of The Atlantic. He says the CDC has made a big mistake when it announced in May that vaccinated people, people who have had a COVID vaccination, could decide whether or not they want to wear masks. They could shed their masks if they wanted to. So he's going to explain why he thinks that is a mistake in public health messaging. But we want to hear from you about that. What do you think about public health more as a shared responsibility rather than a matter of individual choice? Do you feel a duty to others to modify your behavior for the betterment of the entire public's health? Or do you think that everyone actually does bear some individual responsibility? And that's the beginning and end of it. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we're speaking with Jonathan Rauch. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Jonathan, I just wanted to stick for another minute here before we get to solutions to the conformity side of your analysis here, because I think the facile term for it is cancel culture. And I think both the left and the right actually gleefully practice cancel culture when it's convenient to them. But is it fair to say that when you're sort of casting some of your sharpest criticisms on the left, that in a sense you're speaking to your own people?
Well, I'm kind of center right myself. Okay. I don't know what I am. You know, I'm an atheist, homosexual Jew. So you figure that out. I'm a big government conservative, and you know, I don't know what I am, but yeah. So on the left, it's different. I guess the first thing I ought to say, Meghna, just so everyone understands this, is that my criticisms in this book are about the information warfare tactics that are being weaponized and used by factions on the left and right.
Right.
It's not about the left and right points of view themselves. This isn't about immigration, and it's not about facts about race. It's about the tactics that are being used to distort and dominate the public conversation, to isolate or intimidate or disorient the other side. So that's where the problem is. And yeah, canceling, as it came to be called, a word that actually didn't exist when I started my book, but canceling is now predominantly used on the left simply because they have the social power to do that. They're the people who have the reputational credibility to go on Twitter and say, well, you know, Meghna, said something on her show that we don't like, and we've got 4,000 or 400 people who have, or 4 million people who want to get her fired, who want to say that she's a racist, who want to besmirch her reputation or actually go after her friends and say, how can you associate with such a person? They have the power to do that, and they've been using that power, and they've used it quite effectively. They've especially discovered that a soft spot in America's free speech culture is employers. Because mm-hmm. they're there to make money. They're not there to protect controversial speech. And if an employee says something that triggers a firestorm online, their first tendency is to say, well, you know, we'll hire someone who's less controversial. Well, that very quickly creates an environment where people just are chilled all the time. They don't know what they can say. They don't know what's safe to say. And the counselors don't want you to know what's safe to say. They come after progressives. Often it's kind of random things, like a famous case in which an actually socialist, very well-respected Democratic political analyst tweeted out a correct description of an academic study, lost his job the next day after hundreds of people said he was a racist. So it could happen to anyone, anytime. It's like littering the whole environment with landmines so people stay indoors. It's a way of creating mass intimidation. That's why it's really not ideological warfare. It's information warfare. Mm.
Well, I want to give you an example of how immune I think this kind of warfare is, even to the discovery of truth. And use this example as a way to explore how hard it might be to turn the tide here. Because as Jonathan, as I know, I'm sure you know of, that in 2018 on the campus of Smith College, there was a really disturbing event that happened. A young black student recounted an event where she was eating lunch in a dorm room lounge, and a janitor and a campus police officer walked over to her, asked what she was doing there. She felt intimidated, felt that she was being approached only because she was a black student. And she used her voice to share the challenges of being a black student on the campus of Smith College. She said that all she did was be black, and it's outrageous that people questioned her being at Smith College. Okay, so immediately thereafter, Smith's president, Kathleen McCartney, profusely apologized to the student, put the janitor on paid leave that same day, and said, quote, "This painful incident reminds us of the ongoing legacy of racism and bias in which people of color are targeted while simply going about the business of their ordinary lives." Now, in the first couple of days and weeks of this event, it actually seemed pretty straightforward because, yes, racism is real. It actually is a fact of life in the United States. But what happened later, and I'll give full credit to Michael Powell at the New York Times for unearthing this or investigating this deeply. 3 months later, a Smith College investigation, an independent investigation that Smith College had done, basically found no evidence whatsoever of discrimination. It also found that the student, in the course of the investigation, couldn't point to anything that supported her central claim that she made on social media of a year-long pattern of discrimination. She couldn't actually provide any evidence for that. This was a 35-page report that concluded that basically nothing untoward happened. No bias was evident. But here's the thing. Here was an opportunity of the president of a highly regarded liberal arts college to, push back against the effect of what had happened to that janitor. But she offered no public apology to the employees of Smith College after that report was released. None. So I see this as an opportunity for an incredibly intelligent leader of a well-regarded educational institution to say, we will still acknowledge the existence of racism, but we can also use this as, if we truly believe in reconciliation, as an opportunity to acknowledge that some instances are misunderstandings. Some instances are not actually bias. But that didn't happen. So I guess I'm leading to this question here, Jonathan. How can we create a situation where these very components of the constitution of knowledge, as you describe, the elites of the elites of those institutions are actually more accountable in the moments where they can make a difference?
Well, that's a big question, and it's also a heartbreaking story. I think that janitor wound up losing their job, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong about that, but imagine the consequences of being put in that position and not having done something wrong. And what went wrong there was that we did depart from the rules of the Constitution of Knowledge, which says, you know what, let's, before the punishment, before the sanctions, let's find out what actually happened. Let's do that first. And let's do that in an impartial way with a lot of different points of view, carefully balanced. And you're right, that was betrayed there. They put the punishment before the hearing. And then the other thing we're supposed to do in the Constitution of Knowledge is correct if we're wrong. It's not the end of the world to make mistakes. The student may have been mistaken. The president may have been mistaken. But people should then say, look, we made a mistake. Mm-hmm. Journalism, we run corrections. So you ask, how do you fix that? Well, the first and most important things, there are lots of detailed, interesting things that I hope we can touch upon. But here's the first and most important thing, Megna. We won't be able to defend the Constitution of Knowledge. All of these rules and norms, institutions that rigorously hold us to the truth-seeking path, we won't defend the Constitution of Knowledge if we're not aware that there's a Constitution of Knowledge to defend. And for a very long time, this system worked seemingly on autopilot for so well that we kind of forgot it was there. We said, well, you know, we'll just have free speech and we'll solve it. And that turns out to be naive. So the first step is exactly what you just did, which is to take incidents like that, there are many of them, and to reframe that and say, this isn't just about individuals. This is about people failing their institutional responsibilities to put facts first and to put fact-finding first and to use that as the basis for decision-making. So then the next question, I know you're going to ask this, so I'll ask myself, okay, how specifically in a university do you go about doing that? First, you need counter-mobilization. Most students and most faculty at most universities are on the level. They want to do good research. They want to get educated. They want to be exposed to multiple viewpoints. Survey evidence, as well as anecdotal evidence, is very clear on that. What you have on campuses is a very organized subgroup, a faction, which is very outspoken, very vocal, and very competent at weaponizing things like investigations, calling for people's firings, using course evaluations. And one reason they've been so successful is that no one has succeeded very well at counter-mobilizing. So a university president in the situation you just described has on one side a faction of people who will really fight very hard and use all kinds of tactics, including besmirching your university's reputation. And on the other side, crickets. So that needs to change, and that is starting to change. There's a new group called the Academic Freedom Alliance coming out of Princeton, which is organizing nationally. It's going to be a NATO kind of thing for college professors so that the academic freedom of one is considered a threat to all, and they rally to support each other. That will make a difference. There's a host of other new groups that are popping up. The one is at Princeton. Another one separately, it's called Princetonians for Free Speech. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, which has been around 22 years, is launching a big new program to defend these values. And then you've also got to get leadership at the top to understand and defend these values. And that's just crucial because that sets the tone for the whole university. So I'll give you a counterexample, a good example. University of Chicago, a professor on social media somewhere says stuff about affirmative action that some progressives don't like. And they organize the usual campaign of multi-hundreds of signatories demanding an investigation and consequences. And the president of the university, President Zimmer, puts out a short one-paragraph statement that says, in effect, we at University of Chicago believe in free speech. The professor exercises free speech. Nothing happened here to investigate. And you know what happened to him as a result of that? Nothing. Mm. It turns out in many cases, these activists will go away and look for a softer target if we stand up for these values. And if we just say, look, you know, First Amendment speech, We're not investigating that. That's not a wrongdoing. So that can change the incentives all the way down the line. Yeah. Gives professors a sense of protection. Students, same thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, we only have 4 minutes left, Jonathan. The time goes by very quickly.
Sorry.
No.
I'm filibustering.
No apologies necessary. That's the great joy of this show is that we always try to bite off more than we can chew here. But I wanted to just shift back a little to the chaos side of the dichotomy here because, okay, so you gave us some examples about what can happen in universities here. But we also have, as you've well described, politicians who profit politically and sometimes materially off the polarization and the chaos they're creating. And then those tech tycoons that I talked about, I mean, they have enormous power to make even slight changes in how social media works that could slow down the speed of the dissemination of toxic content, throughout society. And yet they steadfastly refuse to do that. So I'm just wondering, and just give me a quick answer here, if you could. What are the tools that we have to extract accountability from them? Because they too, whether we like it or not, are part or sort of powerful arbiters of this constitution of knowledge.
So the big problem here is not the social media companies, it's the politicians. And in fact, social media is number three on the list of people spreading conspiracy theories, fake news. Number two is cable news and talk radio. And number one is good old-fashioned politicians. And yes, we're talking about Donald Trump. So let's be careful about shooting the messenger. But second, our views are different, actually, on social media. For a lot of the same reasons that journalism in the 19th century realized its business model was toxic to its long-run interests, that if it was full of extreme partisanship and fakery and hysteria, it would lose readers, that people hate that environment. Social media has also begun to figure that out. And Twitter and Facebook and a lot of the other ones, maybe too slowly, but I think in good faith, are now looking for ways to change their policies and especially their platform designs in ways that will be more pro-social and will reward sharing stuff that's true instead of stuff that's false, that will try to root out the fake identities, the bots, and the trolls. And I'm especially interested in Facebook's oversight board, which is kind of a Supreme Court that's trying to set accountable rules for how people behave on Facebook and social media. That's how we got out of this 100 years ago, Magna. We set up rules of the road. We had institutions in journalism and elsewhere that said, you know what, let's have ethics codes, let's have guidelines, let's be transparent, let's set expectations for how you behave here. And over time, that actually worked because it created an environment people wanted to be in and did not feel manipulated by. If anything works, it's going to be that. So I see these companies as potential allies that have to be drawn even deeper into the process of reform.
But if and only if Facebook uses the judgments of the oversight board as precedent setting and would apply them across Facebook rather than the case-by-case basis, which it seems to me they're approaching this with. I mean, I should have you back, Jonathan, so we can debate the oversight board here. But with that, I'm so afraid that we've run out of time. The new book is called The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth. We've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Jonathan Rauch, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
I enjoyed it so much, and I'd be happy to come back anytime.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.